Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thanks for downloading Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4. In this programme, I talk to Suzanne Vega. Welcome to Master Tapes. That's the sound of Suzanne Vega playing live for our audience here at the BBC Maida Vale Studios. In this programme, I'll be taking Suzanne back to 1987 and the making of Solitude Standing. It was the second album of her career and included songs such as Luca, Tom's Diner, and of course, the title track.
Solitude stands by the window. She turns her head as I walk in the room. My name is Luca. I live on the second floor. Hold me like a baby that will not fall asleep. Curl me up inside you and let me hear you through the heat. Oh.
Suzanne Vega, welcome to this edition of Master Tapes, in which we'll be taking you back to the making of Solitude Standing. Now, your first album had come out only, 2 years before 1985?
Yeah.
And included that big hit, Marlena on the Wall. So was there immediate pressure to follow up, to produce the quick follow-up?
Yes. In a word, there was tremendous pressure. And as you said, it had done so well here, and everyone could feel a sense of anticipation for the second album. So I'd had some songs that were saved, but there was pressure to write a bunch of new things as well.
Pressure from the record company, or were you
pressure
imposing
from
pressure
my manager.
On yourself? Ah, really?
My manager, Ron Feirstein, who did a great job because he could see what was coming. And I guess there must have been some from the record company, but mostly I remember just from Ron, him calling me every day going, are you writing?
Because that's the difficulty, isn't it? When you have a hit, then you're having to exploit that hit. You're taking it out on the road. So where's the time to write the follow-up?
Well, exactly. So we had to make the time. And we did that by... I had just bought a house with the proceeds from my first album. I'd bought this house out in Cape Cod. And we decided to do what was called woodshedding. And we lived in this house all together with my band at that time. And we would sort of practice in the basement. And some of the songs came together that way.
Let me start with the title track itself and that idea of solitude, which seems to run thematically throughout the whole album. Mm-hmm. The sense of solitude as opposed to loneliness.
Yeah.
Is seen from various perspectives. Did you regard yourself as a solitary person at the time?
Yes. I had just broken up with my boyfriend of 2 years, and it was kind of traumatic, and I was living in this place by myself. It was my first apartment that I'd ever had by myself in the meat market area downtown in New York. But the fact is that I think I've always felt myself to be kind of solitary. Even though I come from a large family and I'm surrounded by people most of the time, I, for whatever reason, have always felt particularly solitary.
Because you grew up in Spanish Harlem, didn't you?
I spent 5 years there.
And your stepfather was the Puerto Rican writer,
yes,
Ed Vega.
Yeah.
And he was, I presume, he was an influence on writing then. Did he sit you down and say, look, you have some kind of talent, you can express yourself with words?
He did. Yes, he did. He told me at an early age that I had a gift for metaphor. I think because when I was a kid, when I would speak, a lot of times it would come out in a picture form. You know, if you say that my stomach is a rumpled blanket, you know, I would say that sort of thing. And he explained to me that's what a metaphor was.
And that came naturally, did it? I mean, that was you saw situations visually, pictorially.
Yes. And when I write a song, very often it'll happen that way. I'll see something in my mind's eye and then try to get to it however I can, either with images or words or sometimes through the music.
Yeah. And do you remember, because so you're talking about writing there and conjuring words. What about the music? When did the music first start arriving?
I always loved music. I mean, as a child, you're all constantly being sung to, and I loved rhymes and rhythms, and all of that just came very naturally to me.
What sort of music were you listening to at home as a kid then?
Pete Seeger. And my parents listened to jazz and folk music, and I had a string of babysitters that would come to our house and play Motown.
Right.
And the Beatles. I loved the Beatles. I was kind of obsessed with them from the time I was 4 years old on to like I was 12 or something.
Yeah. And what was the very first song you wrote? Can you remember?
Yeah. The very first song I wrote, it took me 3 years to finish it, and I was so proud of myself, is a song called Brother Mine. I was obsessed with this fantasy of living in the country, because this was New York City in the 70s, and it was not a fun place to grow up. And I had this fantasy that I used to play with my brothers and sisters that we would all move to the country. And we would play that we were going to move to the country. So it's a rollicking country song, the only one I've ever written with all major chords.
Give us a blast of that then, Suzanne.
Oh, gosh, I'm not prepared for that. All right.
I put you on the spot.
Yes, you did. And it goes like this, you know. I'm not going to sing it. It's way too early in the day. It sounds like this. It goes like that, you know. I mean, it's so un-Suzanne Vega sounding.
Yeah.
Don't you think? So anyway.
But you talked a moment ago about the influence of the, or hearing the Beatles, loving the Beatles.
Yep.
And you started off the program with a blast of Solitude Standing. There is an echo of Eleanor Rigby in Solitude Standing, isn't there, melodically?
Oh, I guess there might be, yeah. I hadn't thought about that, but I think there is a pinch of that.
Yeah.
What I was listening to, actually, at that moment in time was Philip Glass, the Mishima album. So some of his ideas, the minimalist sort of circular patterns were sort of creeping their way into.
I mean, the first album was a big hit, driven by Marlena on the Wall.
Yeah.
And established you as a storyteller. A writer who creates these characters and these situations. And you carried on that approach with yeah. Solitude Standing.
Mm-hmm.
And on the very first track, Tom's Diner,
yeah.
you take us to an archetypal New York location, a situation. And
yes.
and that is a diner that you knew well. It is a real diner in New
York. It's a real diner.
Still there?
Yeah, it's still there. It's called Tom's Restaurant. It's a pretty average place. Even now, when I go there, I still have to wait 20 minutes for them to get a cup of coffee.
You're kidding.
And they have misspelled my name in the menu. so, you know, it's very humbling to go back to one's roots. But it's fine. I didn't write it because it was great beauty. I wrote the song because it was sort of this average little place. Mm. And I wanted to write a song about a person who was alienated. And I kind of had a deliberate narrative voice.
So which came first, the words or the melody?
The melody came to me as I was walking down Broadway one day after I had just left Tom's Restaurant, and I had come up with the idea. I had studied acting in college and theater, and I had taken this course called the Dramatic Monologue, and it was great. We could read things like T.S. Eliot's Wasteland and all this stuff about Prufrock, and so I started to play with the idea that you could write in someone else's voice, and it didn't always have to be your own mess that you were writing about. And that's what I attempted to do with this song, was every single verse has a kind of moment of disconnect.
But just to take you back to the melody, first of all, you leave
yeah.
Tom's Diner, you're walking down the...
Walking down Broadway.
And
yeah.
it's got a walking melody, in fact, hasn't it? The walking rhythm.
Yeah.
And probably a melody which is... Well, the thing is, it's a melody which instantly lodges itself into the listener's brain.
It
and
did
it
in
stays.
Mine, I can tell you that.
Well, and I bet it did in the brains of all the people
head.
That are here today. And in fact, I'm going to put it to the test. 25 years on, I bet the audience here today can instantly sing the melody. In fact, let's put it to the test. One, two, three. Not delivered with particular gusto, but point... Proof.
I thought that was very well done, actually, especially so early, and they weren't even given the note or anything. They were relatively in tune.
That's true. And did you conceive it as an a cappella performance?
No. In my mind, when I heard the song, I had a piano playing in my brain. I don't actually play piano, so this was awkward. And and then I realized, since I don't actually write music, I couldn't write out the part. And I thought, I want to try it out, and I didn't want to wait for a piano player and all that stuff. So I just thought, oh, I'll just try it a cappella. And it worked better than I could have imagined.
And just
it worked so well that I thought, oh, we'll just keep doing this.
Yeah. But to take you back to the street, you're walking down the street, the melody's there. When did the words arrive? Did you get home?
Immediately. No, yeah, it was almost right away. It started, you know, at the beginning. I am sitting in the morning at the diner on the corner. I thought, oh, I like that. And then, you know, and then I sort of fiddled with it for a few days. I am waiting at the counter for the man to pour the coffee, and he fills it only halfway, and before I even argue, he is looking out the window at somebody coming in.
So it's an autobiographical lyric because it conjures in the mind of the listener the person who is sitting there alone. It's an observational lyric as well.
It's an observational lyric, and the other bit of it that's sort of interesting to know is that I have a friend named Brian Rose, and he's a photographer, and we influenced each other a lot back then, and he had made this comment to me that he felt that he saw his life through a pane of glass, and I thought this was a kind of beautiful image, and so I was thinking of Brian when I put together each of these verses. So there's an actual verse where the narrator, who happens to be male, actually, is looking out the window and sees this woman adjusting her skirt. And he thinks for a minute that she's looking at him. But yes, she's actually, she's only seeing herself. There's a woman on the outside looking inside. Does she see me? No, she does not really see me because she sees her own reflection. And I'm trying not to notice that she's hitching up her skirt. And while she's straightening her stockings, her hair has gotten wet. So that was part of what I was thinking of.
And I talked about the rhythmic quality of many of your songs. Of course, this is determined by the rhythm of the words. And yet there is that moment when it switches to reverie and the protagonist is looking out the window, hears the bells.
Yeah.
And the rhythm changes. It slows and it starts to meander and the thoughts turn to your voice, the voice of a friend, somebody who the protagonist doesn't know anymore, doesn't see anymore. And then there's the reference to the midnight picnic. And that's a lovely moment when it wanders off.
Well, the Midnight Picnic was an actual picnic I had on the steps of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, which is right up the street from Tom's
Diner. The bells of which you heard.
Yeah, the bells of which I heard. And so it was a very romantic moment, this picnic on the... And it was a real picnic, not a metaphorical one. I've had people ask me, like, whoa, what's the meaning of the picnic? I'm like, no, we had sandwiches on the steps. It's the actual real thing. Yes, at midnight. I'm not talking about any other things. So, yeah, so that's the one moment of emotion and connection in the song. It's the one moment where the narrator is actually feeling something, and it becomes a little too much. And so that's why there's the big pause, and then it breaks, and then we pick up with the melody and it's time to catch the train. Oh, this rain, it will continue through the morning as I'm listening to the bells of the cathedral. I am thinking of your voice and of the midnight picnic once upon a time before the rain began. And I finish up my coffee, and it's time to catch the train.
That was lovely. Thank you. Do you know what was fascinating there was that you were delivering that in a softer way than the recording on the record. And let me talk about your voice for a minute, because you've always sung in that way, haven't you? There is a sort of a very cool, almost detached quality, and you never sing with vibrato.
No, I never sing with vibrato, that's true.
And is that the natural way you sing? Have you always sung like that?
Yeah. Or was that Well, I started out as singing to my brothers and sisters, and I've just always retained that particular voice, you know.
Can you sing in any other way?
Not very well. The other thing is that for years, you know, it took me a while to learn how to sing into a microphone. So Steve Adabo was the other part of my management team back then, and he would just have me sitting in there until he liked what he heard on tape, which is the way we did it back then. Mm. And it took me so long to have any control over my voice. So actually, I would try and sing loudly, and it sounded terrible. And I would try and sing with emotion, and it was just the worst thing ever. So I realized it just sounded better for my voice to be what it has become.
And what that delivery does, I suppose the lack of emotional adornment, is give primacy to the lyrics and to the stories. You foreground the stories all the time, don't you?
Yeah, I like that. I think, when I go on a stage, that's what I want people to be listening to the lyrics. And And it also affected the way I dressed as a kid. I started going out and trying to get gigs in clubs when I was about 16. And I learned early on that I did not want to wear a dress, because you'd have these guys looking at your legs and making comments. And, you know, you just wanted them to listen to the lyrics. So I started to dress like the people I loved, like Leonard Cohen or Bob Dylan. You know, you didn't see them prancing around wearing weird things, you know. Or, you know, it's just like Leonard Cohen wears a suit every day, you know, for his whole life. So I thought, oh, that's what I'll do. I'll just wear a jacket. And that's kind of stuck.
And Tom's Diner, as an opener to an album, as a first track, it's something of a wild card, isn't it? Because the rest of the album is fairly produced. There's a lush sound to it. There's a sheen, which is, I guess that's a product of the 80s.
Yeah.
A lot of albums of that time sound a bit like that. But just take us back to the recording process. You recorded it in New York City.
Yeah.
And New York is almost a character in its own right on this album as well, isn't it? There are many stories, situations which are played out on the streets of New York. I'm thinking about... in Ironbound,
yeah.
I presume...
Well, that's actually Newark, New Jersey, which is across the river, but
right,
close enough. Yeah.
Ish, yes. Yeah. But then there's a coda to that song.
Yeah.
Fancy Poultry, and the perspective changes, and you evoke the street cries of the vendors.
I was living down in the meat market area of Manhattan, which was an up-and-coming area. Now it's pretty ritzy, and they have all these stores. Yeah, Stella McCartney has a place there and all this. But back then, it was just stalls of poultry and meat, and it was pretty grimy, especially in the morning. But there were it was the signs that really caught my eye, because it almost looked like poetry. Boxed beef, you know, this sort of thing, and you'd be walking around. And so some of the language came from those signs that I saw.
And could you give us a sense melodically of how, again, the words then take on a musical form, especially in that change where in the song Ironbound, it switches to that coda, to Fancy Poultry.
Yeah. Well, the lyrics are fancy poultry parts sold here. It goes into three-quarter time there. It was like that. It's kind of... You know, so that was a little coda that I'd put to the song.
Yeah, and the evolutionary process of the song in the studio. Do you sit there and literally feel your way through the song as you're doing there until it falls into place?
I would do that more privately, and then I would bring stuff out to the band. Actually, this was a new experience for me. Even with the song Solitude Standing, I remember writing it and bringing it out to the guys like the next day, and they had really great arrangement ideas. So they had great rhythmic ideas, and they helped me to write the bridge. So for a long time, I could not play Solitude Standing by myself, which is kind of ironic. I needed a whole team of guys to play it with. And finally, over the years, I did learn how to play it, and now I can play it myself. But it took me a while to actually learn it. Yeah. So for a while, I was starting to include them in some of the... I realized if I played with them that I could open up the process of writing, because I tend to get one good idea and then repeat it. You know, Calypso, one verse, four times. Why not? And then when I started to work with Steve Adubo, he's like, well, what are you doing? You know, you've got no chorus, you've got no bridge. And we started to think about what a classic songwriting form was like, which is sort of like verse, chorus, bridge, verse, chorus. That's sort of a classic form.
And do you play Solitude Standing alone now without a band ever?
Yes, I do. Mm. Yeah, I figured out how to play it myself finally after years.
Yeah, a very quick burst of that.
Oh, yes. Well, it's the one I played before, you know. So then the difficult part was this part coming up. I honestly don't know what you call this. Is this a chorus, a bridge? So for a long time, I couldn't get that fingering. And this was a nightmare. That part, for years, I was just like, where the hell is it, you know? And then I'd look down, and sometimes my finger would miss the spot, you know. You know, it's way up there. So that was... That's where the band came in, really handy,
sure.
Right around there. Mm. Yep.
But when it comes to the lyrics, you're alone. You can't crowdsource opinions on
it. No, and
it's not just the city that you write about on this album. On several tracks, you're drawing on literature and art for inspiration. On the track Night Vision, according to the sleeve notes of the album, you're inspired by the poem Juan Gris by Paul Éluard, the poet. And he's writing about Juan Gris and evoking a sense of a Cubist painting.
I loved it that he wrote this poem about these objects.
I just
thought it was just so great and beautiful, and so I just took the images and put them right in the middle of the song.
But
and I love the idea that he was trying to find the shape through this grain of darkness. That really resonated with me at that moment in time. I had my own guitar and my own table, and, you know, at this moment in time, I was living in that room by myself, and so these few objects that I had really mattered to me. I didn't have that much at that point.
Oh, because that's the reference to the table, the guitar, the empty glass, all will blend together when daylight has
passed. Yeah, it's there in the painting,
passed.
But it was also there
it's
in
there
my
in
own
front
life.
Of you as well.
Yeah, those were the things I had in my house. It's never really about, you know, when I'm writing about Calypso, I'm writing about her, but there's also something that resonates in my own life. It's never just an academic exercise.
But you're a big reader.
Yeah.
And there's a song called Language on the album, isn't there, which is about the power of words, but also...
How difficult it is.
And about silence as well.
Yeah. Yes. Well, my mother says I didn't speak until I was 2.5, and they were worried about me, and then I started reading when I was 3, so they let it go.
And I guess silence is the thematic key to the best-known song on the album, Luca. And there you created this portrait of a young, abused child, and the key line is... Just don't ask me.
Yeah.
And it's because of the silence which allows the abuse to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And Luca was a real kid. He did live upstairs from you?
Yes, there was
a boy. On the second floor?
I never found out. I lived on the first floor, so everybody lived upstairs from me in that apartment. and he might have lived on the second floor. I think that was part of the fiction of the thing. He lived upstairs. He was not an abused child. He was just a child that I used to get his mail by mistake. So I remember looking at the name and thinking, what kind of name is this? I couldn't tell what kind of name if it was Spanish, or it obviously wasn't like your average American name like Bob. There was something about the universality that sort of appealed to me. And then when I saw the child one day waiting for the elevator, I said, what's your name? And he said, my name is Luca. And I said, oh, you're Luca. I said, I have some of your junior scholastics. And he looked completely unconcerned. He was this really kind of sensitive-looking kid, but very tough at the same time. And I sort of appropriated his character for the point of view of the song. Mm. And he was not, I should reiterate, he was not an abused child.
Sure.
This was a different situation. And I had sort of taken a few situations and melded them together into one sort of thing that worked dramatically.
Yeah.
It took me a while to figure out the angle of the way in, of how to write it. And one day when I got the idea, oh, this is the child singing to the neighbor, then the whole thing seemed to write itself in 2 hours one Sunday. You know, at 2 o'clock, I started the song. At 4 o'clock, it was done. And in my journals, there's no other notes around it. It's just the song complete.
You still have the original lyric then? You still have the original
mm-hmm.
notebook?
Yeah, it's in my notebook.
Yeah. Did you have any qualms about using his real name, about creating?
I had no idea that this was going to be a huge hit. I wrote the song in 1984, and we recorded it over the years for release in 1987. So when I first used to sing it, it was not a song that got a lot of comment. A lot of people looked extremely uncomfortable once they figured out what it was about. I think there was a master plan in my manager's mind. I think he felt that there was potential for it to be a big hit. We had actually had a big argument in the beginning. When I first sang that song, he came to me and he said, is this a song about child abuse? And I said, yes, it is, actually. He said, I really think that song could be a big hit. And I just thought he was out of his mind, you know, and I said, I really don't see that at all. But he said, no, it's got a social message, and I think it could have a huge impact. And we actually had a huge argument as to whether songs with a social message actually had any impact. And I argued that they didn't, and he argued that they did. And in the end, I think his vision was more correct than mine.
Hmm.
So when Ron had told me, oh, I think this is going to be a big hit, I thought he was, I thought, are you dreaming?
Right.
Are you dreaming? I said, fine, do whatever you want. You know, he says, no, we're going to work on the production. I said, well, knock yourselves out, because I'm finished with my part of it. You know, you do whatever you like with the production. And they needed to do that kind of production, because if we had come out with it as a simple folk song, it never would have.
It would be too dark?
Yes.
Because?
Yeah. It, Well, even in its great success, I would get letters from people complaining. We don't want to hear about child abuse at drive time and at breakfast and you know, blah, blah. Mm. But I felt that there are some people who don't want to experience it. You know, they don't want to experience it through their lives. And that's more important than your particular breakfast.
But it made you think it's okay. I can write a situation that is this dark and this disturbing.
I felt as free as possible. You know, I felt like I have no limits on what I can write about.
And you are writing from the point of view of a protagonist, a character in a certain situation. Do you have to think your way into that situation before you find
the voice?
And therefore the melody to match.
Yeah.
A melody that evokes that voice.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little more sophisticated than what I actually do. Usually I put myself in the frame of mind and then a melody hopefully kind of comes. Mm. Just grateful when they arrive. You know, sort of like, oh, thank God.
Well, that's all we have time for in this first part of the programme. But, of course, there's a lot more to discuss about Solitude Standing and its legacy. So we'll be continuing this discussion in the second part of this edition of Master Tapes, our B-side, if you like. When our studio audience get to pose the questions, that's at 11 o'clock next Monday night. But for now, Suzanne Vega, thank you very much indeed. Now, as Suzanne gets ready to play us out, there's just time to remind you about the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website, where you can hear all of the programmes in the series and exclusive live versions of some of the songs we've discussed, including this one, Luca by Suzanne Vega.
My name is Luca. I live on the second floor. I live upstairs from you. Yes, I think you've seen me before. If you hear something late at night, some kind of trouble, some kind of fight, just don't ask me what it was.
And if you want to hear more material recorded at this Master Tape session, including exclusive performances, photographs and videos, go to the Master Tapes pages via the Radio 4 website.